We're here because, perhaps because of all the headlines, and certainly in Vancouver we have a lot of headlines referring to the use of tasers in Canada. I'm from Vancouver, so of course my headlines are in Vancouver, but I'm also aware that these headlines appear across the country. You know, the taser deaths and incidents involving tasers. Oops. And then, you know, editorials that are critical of the police for the use of tasers, and headlines that are very leading in terms of what people are led to believe about the use of tasers across the country. So my presentation tonight is, I'll do a bit of an introduction to Amnesty International. After all, that's where I'm from. A little bit about the context for our work on tasers, and it's within our military security and police work, and the emergence of electroshock devices. So where did these things come from? Our impressions of taser use in Canada, some of the Amnesty International reports that have been issued on taser use in Canada as well as in the United States. The Braidwood Commission, and I'll talk a bit about that and my impressions of attending some of those hearings, our key recommendations, and I'm aiming for about 35 minutes, so hopefully I can keep to that with these slides. So Amnesty International, worldwide movement of people. How many here actually are members or are pretty familiar with Amnesty International? Okay, very good. I always like to see that. So 2.2 million members around the world, largest human rights organization in the world, members all over the world. And a point that I always like to make is that we're independent of government, so we don't take any government money. That way we're essentially free to be critical of any government or government agency where we're concerned about their human rights violations. And many of you will know that Amnesty has been around since 1961. And our initial focus was basically freedom of expression. We were concerned about people being able to express their religious and political beliefs and the frequency with which people were actually imprisoned for doing so. Amnesty now takes on the full range of human rights that are envisioned in the Declaration of Human Rights as well as other covenants and conventions and treaties and international standards. I mentioned that we have been working on military security and police issues, and we've been doing this for about 25 years. So as Amnesty took on more and more work, one of the areas we looked more closely at back in the mid-80s was this whole issue of the kind of equipment, personnel, technology that was being transferred across borders, where it was pretty clear and reasonable to expect that transfer would result in the violation of human rights. So the transfer of you know, usual military equipment, the training that might go on, where that training was going to lead to the violation of human rights. The training of torturers, for example, would be a serious issue for us. And we called, of course, for international action, as we do with all of our issues. At the same time, we applied direct pressure to military security and police officials themselves. Usually, it would be the top level management of those organizations, and making sure, one, that they weren't violating human rights, or if they were, that they were bringing those people responsible for violating human rights, and that they, not just the privates, for example, but everyone throughout the structure that would be responsible for making decisions around the violation of human rights in those settings. In the 1970s, we became aware of the development of electroshock technology. And by the 80s, 30 companies were producing all manner of weapons and tools, stun batons, stun guns, various weapons that used electricity. And of course, with that comes the possibility, and in the initial stages, sorry, that's not 1908, that's 1980s. In the initial time, there was actually no hesitation on the part of the U.S. government to allow this equipment to be transferred to countries where it could be used for especially for torture, whatever else it might have been used for. These kinds of weapons are very much implicated in the torture of many, many prisoners in many parts of the world. By 2000, more than 130 companies in a variety of countries were producing weapons along these lines. And so you can see it becomes quite an issue to have this many companies and this many countries producing these kinds of weapons. So we started to become really concerned with these weapons. And we issued a number of reports on the use of electroshock technology. Stun belts were a particularly onerous tool that we were opposed to, and they were initially being used for only extremely dangerous prisoners, transporting them to and from court and so on. But they became more widely used in the prison systems in the United States. And the problem with them is that at the push of a button, you can send an 8-second, 50,000-volt jolt to prisoners' kidneys. And once you start that, you can't stop it. So it was we characterized it as a cruel and inhumane treatment of prisoners, and eventually the United Nations Committee Against Torture called for the abolition of stun belts. In 2003, we issued a report on the trade in weapons, and again called for the suspension of stun guns or the banning of stun guns and suspension of use of equipment whose medical effects were not fully known, including high voltage electroshock weapons. So we're starting to see on the market the kinds of guns that and weapons that were basically electroshock weapons that would send electro signal, usually still by touch. You'd have to be close to the person to make use of it. But we were seeing them being used in a variety of ways, variety of settings. And we were very concerned about the complete lack of rigorous and independent research on the medical effects of these weapons and the complete lack of public discussion around the introduction of these weapons by military and police forces. So that's just an example of a report from about, I think, 1990 or 2000, stopping the torture trade. So we were looking at the ways these weapons were being used expressly for the purposes of torture. Oops, oh, sorry. So, in the context of all this, all these weapons being produced with electroshock weapons, came the conducted energy weapon, the CEW. Sometimes it's called the conducted energy device, and sometimes it's called the electronic control device. So, you see those three phrases used interchangeably a lot. Taser is actually a brand name for products marketed by the Taser International based in Scottsdale, Arizona. There are other stun guns on the market, none in Canada. In Canada, there's just two models in use currently, the M26 on the left and the X26 on the right. So these are the two models that are currently approved for use in Canada. And essentially, according to Taser, it's a compressed nitrogen that propels these two probes 15 to 35 feet at a speed of over 160 feet per second. The probes are connected by wire to the gun, and with the trigger, you basically transmit an electric signal, and it's a pulsing signal. There's a lot of technical information that I'm not going to go into, but essentially, the result is a loss of your muscle control. You basically drop to the ground with this weapon. And I just happened to find this illustration from a Seattle newspaper showing you a side view of the weapon, the air cartridge at the front that throws the probes out, and an interesting chart that shows as your target is further away, the probes actually spread a bit further. So you do have to be fairly close in, relatively close in. You can't be too far away or you're likely to miss the target. And according to the company, Taser International, they have their stun guns in 13,000 law enforcement, correctional, and military agencies in 44 countries around the world. So it's in widespread use. They claim to have sold 359,000 of their devices to law enforcement agencies since 1998. And they had several models before the two that are used in Canada. And they now have what's called a C2, which is the personal Taser. And they've sold 176,000 of those in 43 states in the United States. It's a lower power weapon, but it is available. You can buy it in stores in 43 states in the U.S. And interestingly, in the news, you'll see, not in Canada, but in American news, you'll see people on the street getting into fights with these things and using them against the police, in fact, as well. And so it has become a problem in that way. They're not legal for individuals to possess in Canada, right? Okay. We're happy about that. Okay, Taser use in Canada. The first pilot project for Taser use in Canada was in 1999, and it was near my home turf in Victoria. The police department had did a pilot project for 6 months, And I believe they actually deployed the taser about 11 times over that six-month period and felt that that was enough of a test. And at the same time, or over the next couple of years, a lot of other communities across Canada were also testing use of the taser. It was approved for RCMP use in December 2001, approved for use in Ontario in 2002, and approved for use in other provinces along the way. I'm not sure when it was approved in Alberta, probably in that time frame somewhere. Most provinces kind of got involved about that time. However, soon after these were approved for use, we started seeing them being implicated in excessive use of force allegations and a growing number of deaths in custody, which resulted in Amnesty putting together a pair of reports. You'll notice they have essentially the same title, issued in November 2004, where we looked at the use of tasers in Canada and the use of tasers in the United States. And at that time, in 2004, we had noted there are 9 deaths in Canada in the previous 15 months and 60 deaths in the U.S. over 3 years after use of the weapon. So I just want to make a point here that we've never said and we don't say that tasers cause deaths. What we do say is that there are a number of deaths that have resulted after use of the weapon. So I think that's an important point to make. The manufacturer will say there have been no deaths caused by tasers. However, it's a sequence of events that often result in death, and the tasers are often implicated in that sequence. And our concern with tasers is that they're inherently open to abuse by unscrupulous law enforcement officials. They're portable, easy to deploy, you're at a distance from the subject, and they're being used in situations where police force or police would not otherwise use lethal force. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. How are we doing? Pacing's okay, I'm not too fast, and clear? Okay, excellent. Sometimes I get too excited and I start going really fast and people are going, whoa, hold on. Okay. Since 2004, we've issued a few more reports. We issued one in March 2006. Again, if these reports, we generally will talk about our general concerns. Then we'll bring up specific examples or cases that illustrate the points that we're making, and then we'll have our recommendations, and I'll talk about that in a little bit as well. So in March 2006, there had been a number of additional deaths in the United States, so we expressed our continuing concern around the use of tasers in the United States. And then in May 2007, it was time to again look back at what was happening in Canada, and again, what we felt were inappropriate and excessive use of tasers across the country. In 2007, we issued a brief to an inquiry of the U.S. Justice Department. Now, the Braidwood Commission. This is something the first phase took place back in May and June. It was called as a result of the death of Robert Jukansky at the Vancouver airport almost exactly a year ago. How many here have seen the video? Well, certainly have read about it. It was quite widely played and kind of a horrifying illustration of use of taser and other issues that go with that. So this hearing this public proceeding was called, and it's being held in two phases. The first phase took place back mostly in May, with one additional date in June. And the second, and it was, and I'll just pop ahead, it was addressing two key issues in terms of the use of tasers in Canada. One was to look at the appropriate use of conducted energy devices, which are tasers, and the kind of appropriate training and retraining that should be attached to the use of tasers. The second phase, which my previous slide mentioned, has been postponed until November 12th. That will look at the surroundings, or the events surrounding the actual death of Robert Jukansky. So at this commissioning hearing, a whole variety of officials and experts and concerned citizens and agencies and organizations made presentations. It was a study commission, this first phase, which meant that people were there voluntarily. You were not under oath. You were not being cross-examined. And you could not be compelled to provide evidence. So basically, it was an informal, voluntary hearing to provide the commissioner with a wide scope of information and ideas about use of tasers. And so we heard from a variety of medical professionals, emergency room surgeons, people had done research themselves on use of the taser, people that had used the taser themselves. So there's 11 municipal police forces in BC, and they were all represented at the commission. The RCMP spoke at the commission. Organizations that are concerned about use of tasers spoke at the commission. So Amnesty International, the BC Civil Liberties Association, some mental health organizations, some lawyers who are representing individuals who have experienced taser, or lawyers representing families of people who died following the use of a taser. So quite a range of presentations. The commission was also going to be on its own researching a variety of issues. So they had staff that were assigned to the commission that were going to be looking at the legal framework for kinetic energy weapon use, comparing the individual police force rules, policies, and procedures. And it varies quite dramatically, certainly in the province of BC. The 11 forces all had different policies on use of taser, deployment of tasers, and had different language in their policies. And this is something that had been difficult for Amnesty to get a hold of, these policies. But because they were submitted to the commission, we were allowed to go down to the commission office and make notes from their policies. And you know, some have reference to active resistance or assailants. Some are very clear that they'll only be used if the officer's or the public's life is threatened or serious threat of serious injury. So there's quite a range of times when people would be when the taser might be allowed to be used, and also a great variance in terms of what kind of training was required and then the frequency of retraining or recertification. And the commission is also going to be looking at scientific and medical issues. Now, I mentioned that the presenters came from a wide variety of backgrounds and had lots of different ideas about the taser, and use of taser and the impact of the taser. So a huge variety of opinions on when and how to use tasers, and certainly some that said should not be used, period. So not even getting to that question, but just that they shouldn't be used at all. The adequacy of the training, often the training was described as being very technical, but not around the broader police issues and how that weapon should be used. The existence of excited delirium, that's a point of contention for a lot in the medical field or research field, this idea that there is such a thing called excited delirium. Many medical professionals will say there isn't such a thing. There's delirium, and there are clusters of symptoms, but it's not a medical term. Others insist that, no, they see it every day. For example, one of the surgeons in the hospital said, no, it exists. It is. You know, maybe it's not in the dictionary, but it's there. So lots of discussion about what that means and whether police are actually in a position to even make that diagnosis, you know, in any given situation. The likelihood of cardiac arrest, and I put etc. there because that's my layman's term for a whole variety of issues around heart condition, ventricular fibrillation, pH levels in the blood, acid levels in the blood, a whole range of things that the medical professionals talked about, which way over my head. And they all had different ideas about the likelihood of the taser resulting in any damage or consequences from deployment of a taser with somebody who is exhibiting the symptoms of what people are calling excited delirium. Pig versus human tests. Many of the initial tests on the taser for quite a few years were done on pigs. And so some medical researchers will say, well, that's not enough. It has to be on human tests. And then you get into the topic of the human tests. Often they're on healthy individuals. The taser will talk about tens of thousands of tests, but those are on police officials and military officials, which you would assume to be in pretty healthy condition. And often the tests are, they're lying on the ground for that test because of the danger of injury in the fall. And of course that's not a field test. So then you have the question, are the lab tests really worthwhile? Or should we be really looking more closely at how it's actually being used in the field and what the consequences are of its use in the field? Whole debate about original research versus reviews. So people would say, oh, there's all kinds of research been done. But you look at more closely at it, and a lot of that research is simply a review of the previous research. And there's a lot of that out there. And so that was another thread of debate within the various presentations that were being made. And then the last question that I would consider in that category of claim and counterclaim during the commission hearings was the whole issue of funding. A great number of the studies that were presented were in fact fully or partially funded by Taser International. Some of the speakers were there on Taser International's dime. They were either advisors to Taser and were paid to make presentations, or they were otherwise associated with Taser and may not have been paid to be at that hearing, but have a close association with Taser International. And our concern, of course, is that there hasn't been adequate, independent, rigorous research into the use and effects of the Taser. Ooh, did I offend someone already? Doesn't usually happen until at least half an hour. So, claims and counterclaims. So the Annie's presentation. My colleague from Ottawa, Hilary Holmes, was the official Amnesty presenter at this hearing. And she's our campaigner with responsibility for all of our military security and police campaign work or research and action materials. And so she made a presentation to the commission, and I wanted to just highlight a few of the points that she made during that presentation, which I thought were really important. And I might read a slight excerpt. I don't want to take too much time, but I'll read maybe another excerpt or two. But basically, one of the points that she wanted to make at the very beginning was that we're not anti-police. So sometimes she gets called up, and I get called up, you know, there's going to be a panel, there's going to be a police officer on this side, and they want Amnesty on that side to have a fight. And we say that that's not our role. We're not anti-police. And in fact, that it's regretful that they're often cast as only as perpetrators of human rights. I mean, you saw the headlines earlier. And of course, we only hear about the police when there's a problem. And then our position is that, in fact, police play a vital role in protecting human rights. And Article 28 describes the need for social order. And that's the responsibility of the police. And they need to have the right tools and guidance to provide that for our full enjoyment of human rights. We're also not opposed to the use of force by police. And that's not a question, actually, that comes up very often. But I think it's something that does need to be said. Our concern isn't about the use of force. Our concern is with the misuse of force by police in this case. And we measure that against a variety of international standards. And basically, they boil down to two kind of critical points. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about them. But least amount of force necessary to resolve a situation, and the use of force should escalate and de-escalate as a specific situation requires. And here's the two main documents, international documents, that we point to or that we measure police activity against, and the UN Code of Conduct for Law Enforcement Officials and the Basic Principles on Use of Force and Firearms by Law Enforcement Officials. So these are two UN codes of conduct and basic principles, and that we point to when we're concerned about what police are up to. These are two documents that we'll make reference to. Among others. I mean, there's a general human rights documents that we'll refer to, but these two particularly cover police and use of force issues. And what we're looking for essentially is a human rights approach to the use of force. And we know that sometimes use of force will be necessary and it's not pretty, but it has to be proportionate to the lawful objective being pursued and the seriousness of the offense. And that it should not be the first resort, but rather an exceptional measure based on ongoing assessment of the evolving situation. And I think my next slide, So with that in mind, Hilary outlined a number of our concerns around the use of Taser. And these are reflected in our reports and in our other statements that we've made over the years. So inadequate oversight and public disclosure on the use of Tasers by police forces across Canada. As I mentioned, it was really difficult for us to get any information from the police on their use of force policies or on the use of Tasers and Taser policy particularly. Some of you might have seen the Canadian Press CBC reports back in June, July, where they finally got hold of RCMP records on use of force and particularly use of Taser. Some really interesting numbers came out of that, which I might share with you later. Lack of comprehensive data collection across jurisdictions. Tasers are in use by various police forces, actually 170 police forces and corrections facilities or departments across Canada have tasers. And they have very different ways of collecting that data. So there's no consistent collection of that data, and there's no compiling or collection in a national sense of that data. To really get a good picture of what's happening in Canada, that's just isn't that information available yet. And there's a lack of consistency in training and retraining guidelines and reporting, so kind of touching that a bit. Each police department, and this is true in BC, so I can't speak for Alberta, but in BC, each municipal police department develops its own policies on use of force and use of taser policy. Now, they are supposed to adhere or look to the national use of force framework. I have a slide actually of that at the very end, which I'll show you just to give you a sense of what that looks like. But within that framework, they have freedom to develop their own policies and procedures. So that's a bit of a concern because I think my next slide. Yeah. So which means that if a particular jurisdiction is doing something well, that doesn't necessarily get shared with others, and certainly doesn't get applied to others. There's been an attempt in BC to have a provincial framework for use of tasers, but it's been stalled because they haven't got the wording right. They're not happy yet with what they've come up with. That was the provincial coordinator for use of force was at the hearings, and they've got a policy in mind, but they haven't been able to finish it. And even if when they finish it, they don't actually have the authority to enforce it or impose it on the municipal police forces. I'm guessing it's probably similar in Alberta. And of course, I've already mentioned this, there hasn't been an adequate comprehensive study into the use and effects of tasers, including, and perhaps even more importantly, the use of tasers in combination with other force options. I think those of us who recall the unfortunate incident at the airport will see that there was not only use of tasers, but there also was restraint. And so there's questions about the combination of those two things that really get at how they should be used and the conditions and so on. Usage creep, another concern for Amnesty and others. It's been pointed out by many, where it's being used in more and more what we would characterize as low-risk situations where individuals are not actively resisting. And the story I have about that is just before the commission started, the policy of the Greater Vancouver Transit Police, and I got their name slightly wrong, I think, was that it was a passive resistance, or just someone running away could be tasered. In fact, that did happen. Just before the commission started, they changed the wording to active resistance because they were already feeling public pressure around the low threshold for deployment of tasers. So the way that Hillary put it was that the deployment has been too soon and too often across the country by police. And that becomes a real issue. And that's where we see not necessarily fatalities, but certainly just the fact that it's being used too soon and too often is a concern to us. The touch-stun mode can too easily result in arbitrary or excessive use of force. So we're actually opposed to the use of it in the stun mode, or the touch-stun mode, which means you have to be up to the person. Our position is that then it's no longer a standoff weapon. It's being used for other purposes, often for pain compliance. And so we're very concerned about the use of it in the stun mode, touch mode, that is. I just wanted to mention mention something else from Hillary's report. No, I think I'll leave that. I'm going to talk enough here. As some of you will know, there have been a number of reports, commissions, and inquiries into the use of taser in Canada. Two particularly important reports came out in 2005. Office of the Police Complaint Commissioner in BC and the Canadian Police Research Centre both issued reports. There were some of the same people were involved in those reports, and they actually used some of the same source materials and reports. They used the phrase, I think, in the promotion for this event, talked about, are tasers lethal? I think that was the question, wasn't it? Lethal or non-lethal? The term that, that the two reports in 2005 used was lower lethality, which it says more accurately conveys the notion that death may be associated with these technologies. So they were beginning to acknowledge the some of the issues with tasers. And they also, the reports talked about excited delirium. So they both, these reports, accepted the idea of excited delirium, calling it a symptom cluster. But they did call for new medical protocols. They did want it. They did want more medical research into what that means, and for there to be more coherent national and even international standards around this idea of excited delirium and how police and others should respond to that situation. The reports also acknowledged Amnesty's concerns and thought that our recommendations around accountability and cases where if tasers are going to be used, or if tasers are going to be deployed where they shouldn't be used, they did support us in that area, but they did take issue with what they felt we downplayed the risks associated with officers attempting to subdue an unarmed individual. So the reports, our reports talk about the number of times that tasers are used against unarmed individuals, and these reports said, well, we need to take that, look at that more closely, because serious injury can still result to both parties in an arrest situation, even when there are no weapons involved. So I'm probably nodding heads there. Yeah, actually. The other report, okay, so with the second report, the Canadian Police Research Center Review of Conducted Energy Devices, it also talked about how officers need to be aware of the adverse effects of multiple consecutive cycles of a conducted energy device on a subject. Also need to be aware of the concerns problems with targeting the head, neck, or genitalia, and also where a person could fall after being tasered. And this was made really clear just 3 days ago in New York, maybe 4 days ago in New York. A man, clearly off his meds, was up on a ledge, naked, waving a fluorescent tube at the police, and he was tasered, and he basically fell off the ledge onto the concrete sidewalk below and died. And the police had made no, had paid no attention or had done nothing to prepare for the eventual fall. The whole point of the taser is you lose all muscle control and you are going to fall. And the lack of any kind of planning for use of that weapon and use of the very logical expected outcome of him falling, nothing was done. And apparently they had access to a big pillow, like they have a thing that can blow up real quick, but they didn't deploy that. And so they're really being taken to task for lack of consideration of the circumstances of that particular tasering incident. There's also a big issue with, and this report pointed out, the police need to be very careful if the subject is doused in any kind of flammable material, is carrying flammable material, or it's in an environmental, it's an environment that's flammable, explosive, because there are issues with putting electricity into that situation. That report also pointed out that there are no known, scientifically tested, independently verified, and globally accepted connected energy device safety parameters. So with all other weapons and tools in the police arsenal, there are international standards around the use of that equipment. There are none for conducted energy devices. So they call for more research in a variety of areas, including the research on how individuals resisting arrest are often the ones that die in police custody. And I understand that there's a new report coming out. It's been delayed till sometime next year, but it's looking at specifically the whole issue of resisting arrest and the combination of tasers and other restraint forms. So that there's some research being done on that, but we're waiting to see what that looks like. Just very quickly, the two last reports that came out this year, just back in August, one was the House of Commons report that also. Both of these were a result of the airport incident. The House of Commons report and the Commission for Police Complaints, of course, both were very critical of the RCMP for their whole use of taser and their policy on use of taser and where they placed it in the use of force spectrum. And both reports made numerous recommendations. The House of Commons report had 17 recommendations for the RCMP, and the Police Complaints Commissioner had 12 recommendations for the RCMP. Since then, some of them have been addressed because there was actually an interim report, so the RCMP did address some of the issues and are now restricting use of the tasers to incidents involving threats to officers or public safety. They're now going to go through an annual recertification. There's going to be enhanced use of force reporting, promised quarterly and annual reports on taser usage. But there's still some work to be done on that. So our recommendations. So here's my last couple of slides. We are calling for a moratorium on the use of tasers and similar devices by law enforcement officials until there's been independent and comprehensive study of their use and effects. So I keep coming up to that, and that's what's still needed. In the absence of a moratorium, because Amnesty, of course, has our perfect world, then we have, okay, what's happening on the ground, and tasers are being used, and so we push very strongly for their use to be restricted to situations where officers face an imminent threat or would otherwise be justified in resorting to lethal force. And we've just published what's called our Human Rights Agenda. It's kind of a special election issue. And in that report, we list a number of issues we want Canadian politicians and the Canadian government to consider and possibly for questions to be asked at candidates' forums on a whole variety of issues around things happening in Canada and Canada's role in the world in terms of our foreign policy. So here's, again, we reiterate our call for the study, and we're looking for cooperation between the federal government and the provincial and territorial counterparts to impose that moratorium. I did have a comment from Hillary's presentation I wanted to bring in here, just to reinforce that we're not anti-police, that we think police have a very important job that is undeniably challenging, and that careful judgment needs to be exercised in context which can change rapidly. The risks faced by police are not to be taken lightly, and that's something that is recognized in the human rights framework that we would propose. The preamble to the United Nations Basic Principles on the Use of Force and Firearms that I referred to earlier says, a threat to the life and safety of law enforcement officials must be seen as a threat to the stability of society as a whole. A really important point for us to keep in mind in this work. So I think that brings me to the close of my presentation. We do have an action on our website, so if you go to our website, amnesty.ca, pull down on the priority concerns menu, you'll find a section on tasers. And I just wanted to show you the use of force diagram, or the framework for use of force. It's something that I wasn't familiar with until I attended the commission. I always thought of use of force as being along a line. You know, my kind of limited knowledge of, I thought, okay, it's a continuum. You know, there's talking to somebody, and at the other end, there's shooting someone. So it was quite interesting to see how it's actually organized. This is a national use of force framework that was developed by the Canadian Association of Police Chiefs, and it is a suggested framework for all of the police services across Canada. The RCMP have their own version. It's a similar looking diagram, but it has some extra bits and pieces here and there. And right now, generally, the taser is in that intermediate weapon, the outside, well, it's blue on my screen, but it's not quite blue here. It's not very clear, actually, is it? But here's the intermediate weapons. That's generally where police departments place the taser. And you can see there's quite a range around the circle there for that placement. You know, starting with active resistance, although I understand this can't be considered linearly, but it does, you know, if you look at this quickly, you'll see active resistance on through to assaultive. So we're basically saying that if it's going to be used, it should be used more at this end. Sorry, I'm pointing at my screen. It should be used more at this end than at that end. So that's just a nice visual piece to leave you with. So I think that's the end of my presentation. And of course, I look forward to hearing from our the police chief here and any others that want to respond. And then we'll have questions after break, probably? Okay, great. Thank you. Don't mean to keep that up, or I'll leave it up here.
Yes. So we have our police folks here, and not the RCMP. RCMP were invited, naturally, and they chose not to come to this one, but we are very pleased. And I guess you guys have decided who would come up first to give us nothing as long as the major one, of course, but if you'd like to come come forward, and then we will get questions after. We'll have a little break, some water or whatever. And, so it looks like it's Tom McGinley to start this.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. It's my pleasure to be here this evening to talk to you and to listen to the presentation by Mr. Wright. Believe it or not, we're not very far off what Amnesty International would like to see. Very correct statement is reflected in our mission of the Lethbridge Regional Police Service, is providing safe communities. We are apolitical. We don't represent any one particular view. We're here to make sure that your life and your safety is protected and that you're afforded all the rights that you should under the constitutions of not only our country but the world. And, you know, when devices are used inappropriately and when torture is subject, then we should be the first guys there throwing those individuals in jail. There's a lot covered here today, and I don't take issue with anything that's been said by Amnesty International. I think it's correct. It's sort of contextual statements, though, on what context you're taking them and what and when is it used and how is the instrument used is where the issues arise. I'm very proud to be able to stand up here today and say that in Alberta we've made a lot of headway when it comes to conductive energy devices. And I know that Garth Wright, the inspector from the RCMP, was going to be with us up to about 3 days ago. A national decision from Ottawa made the decision that he would not attend. Their report is out, and I think they're still working through it with their service. The difficult thing for the RCMP, of course, is they are a national service, so they have many different groups, provinces and ideals to represent, from an Eastern Canadian philosophy to a Western Canadian philosophy. And I think every one of us that kind of data mines any of the information out of papers around any political issue recognizes that it's pretty controversial as we step across our great country. And I think it's one of the things that makes our country great. And I'm very, very pleased, and it's said to the Herald today, that I'm very, very pleased that our society is actually concerned about a level of violence that goes with any piece of equipment that any of our officers carry, and rightfully you should be, and you should hold us accountable, and you should question us. But to move on to it, I'll just talk a little bit about where we are in Alberta. The provincial government has clear standards for the use of conductive energy devices, the taser, in the province. These are guidelines that set out. They don't necessarily dictate exactly how we would do it. And yes, we are, as services, allowed to tweak that a little bit and put in what it would be, but we have to meet certain standards, and that is around training. So, for example, every officer that uses one of these devices has to have received training. Our fellows undergo an 8-hour training to begin with. The province then calls for biannual recertification, so every second year. Our officers recertify every year, so they receive training in this each and every year. We do have to keep track of our reports, and I do. I have a record from 2005 on going with me tonight, talking about the number of deployments and the particular uses. And in Alberta, we have a use of force report, and we do have a use of force continuum, and I'd have to depend probably on Kyle and Bill, who see it a little bit more frequently than what I do. Bill has worked with our service, and he's now with the Blood Tribe Police, assisting them in developing provincial standards. We in Lethbridge are also accredited through the CLIA, through the International Law Enforcement Accreditation Agency. This we've been accredited 4 times. They look at the use of force issues. They look at policies and procedures around use of force devices. So everything from OC spray, batons, to the use of our conducted energy devices as well as our weapons. And so we have a lot of guidelines that are there. We're very accountable, and we're very pleased to be accountable. And each and every time that there is a taser use, from pointing that device to the deployment, so shooting the probes out, to the actual drive stuns where they are held against the body, and that would be one issue maybe where we differ a bit. I can tell you very clearly that very lethal force can be subjected to our officers or to the individual in close hand-to-hand combat as well as it can at a distance. There's far too many incidents of officers having their guns wrestled away from them or happening to shoot the individuals that have taken their guns or the individuals shooting those officers. So
If you're on the ground struggling for your life and the only thing you can get your hand on is your weapon, I would suggest most of our guys are going to use that weapon and the individual will be dead. If he has the option and does have a taser on his hand where he can use that to subdue that offender, that is the better option. It's the option we'd always like to see. But again, it's open debate and which level are we going to go to? And with each circumstances, and unfortunately that is the problem with the use of force, it's very circumstantial. Each situation can be so very different but so much alike. And it's about proper training. Our fellows do, besides the training they get on conductive interviews, get use of force training every year. So we talk about things like hand-to-hand combat. We talk about the use of a chokehold that was actually one of the earliest things that people protested against, the carotid chokehold, where people were thought to be dying based on that when police were restraining them. And it was something that our service came out against and said we will not use it anymore. I was trained in the late 70s, that's the late 70s, it makes me sound younger. And the use of that hold, when I first joined the police service, it wasn't very long after that we were told to stop using it, and it started to provide us more tools. So when I first went on the beat, I had a gun belt with the Smith & Wesson, 6 shots, and a large flashlight. And that was what I used to defend myself walking the beat in downtown. A lot of us were of my stature. So it wasn't usually a big concern. Most policemen were hired for size, not necessarily brains. I was the exception. and now as we change, we have all shapes and sizes. And our tools have increased. And so we give a baton or an asp. And basically, a baton is a metal stick. The LC spray. Batons, of course, can be attributed, as any blunt force instrument can, to death. And if it's misused, it's a tragedy. LC spray has been attributed to death of individuals. It's a tragedy if that happens and if it's misused. And it could also be used inappropriately. And then now conducted any device. And I'm not going to say for a minute that they're not misused. They are. I've clearly demonstrated in the media. But I can tell you that in Lethbridge, in all of our incidents, and in particular since I've been the chief, I've had one recent internal investigation conducted, and we interviewed 6 civilian witnesses. We interviewed 3 police officer witnesses, and we interviewed parents and doctors and paramedics that attended to deal with the individual that actually had been, the conducted energy device was deployed. Just as the one officer shot it, the other officer raised his arm and broke the leads. So this individual was able to continue his fight, knock the police officer down, run a city block where he was again tackled and suffered most of his injuries when his head struck the pavement. He had a great big road rash down the side of it. His wrist was twisted in the struggle, at which time a drive stun was done because the officer that had control of him, that had chased him for that block attack, and was losing control. The other officer arrived on scene, used the taser to drive stun that individual. They got compliance, handcuffed the individual, had first aid administered by the paramedics, and then he was taken to jail. Based on what I had seen, all of the officers followed policy and procedures. All of the witnesses, civilian and police, supported that. This gentleman was very combative and was restrained at the appropriate level. None of us like violence. There's no room in our society for violence, and that's why it is great. I recognize that our community does raise questions about the use of our force and how we're doing it. And we're very open to it. So each and every time there is one of these deployments from pointing it, and in 2008 so far we've had 3 incidents where it's been pointed. We've had 4 where they've actually shot the probes. And we've had 1 with the drive stun. So that's a 9 incidents so far this year. When we look back to 2007, we had 14 deployments. And those 14 deployments took the form of 6 points. So they just pointed and said, calm down, you're going to get tased. And the individual did comply. 6 where the probes were actually deployed or the weapon was fired. And 2 drive stuns. When you look at those stats, that's 0.049%. At the times that we interacted with our citizens, we had 24,348 calls for service. That's when somebody has actually phoned us. That doesn't include the times we've stopped people on the street to question them what they're doing, traffic stops, people that have come to the front counter and dealt with us. This is when we've actually responded to a call into our call center and sent a policeman 24,000 times, 28,348 times, sorry. And out of those situations, in 14 occasions, we had to use that device. And each and every one of those devices, as with every year, comes to me in what is known as a use of force report. The officer submits that to his sergeant, his supervisor, street supervisor. That street supervisor goes over it with the duty staff sergeant, who is the overall shift supervisor. It then comes upstairs to the executive, which is the four inspectors. My four inspector, it goes from the staff sergeant to the use of force team. We have trained experts in the use of force. They review it to make sure that policy, procedures, and guidelines have been met. It then comes to the executive. Each of the four inspectors reads it before it lands on my desk, and I sign off approval or disapproval or direct that further inquiry be made. So that is there, and that does meet provincial policy and procedures. We set it out very clearly that our officers are only to use this when the individual that they are dealing with is a danger to themselves or others, need to be immediately controlled, so he's actively assaulting somebody, he's going for a weapon, there is a need to immediately get him under control or her. We'll be actively resistant or assaultive towards police officers, so yes, starting in the bottom of that continuum and going up, most of our uses, we would agree, should be in the higher end of that circle. And it's not lineal, and it is in a circle for a very clear reason. We just don't go this way. We go. And we spin through every situation we're in, not with one set thing in mind, but the set thing that is in mind is to come up with the best resolution. So we don't set it up where you give them a warning, then you take out your baton and you hit them, then you take out your OC and you spray them, and then you go to the conducted energy device, and if that doesn't work, you actually take out the weapon and shoot them. That's not how it works. We say, these are the options you have. Take the training that we provide you each and every year and that we drill into your heads. Think about being safe. Think about protecting others and protecting the individual and deal with it. So, and then other force of options available are inappropriate or ineffective. Every one of our officers will be going through, again, here in the very near future, verbal judo training. Before we called it tactical communication. Tactical, a lot of people think of tact teams with tactical communications. Just simply, when you call me an idiot, I have to be able to say back to you in a way that's going to diffuse it, that, no, I have a different opinion than you right now. I need you to do something different. Please think about this. Now, ways of diffusing situations verbally, all of our officers are encouraged to do that first and every time, and it's a very much expectation. Proud to say, I guess, that most situations, our officers are actually using their mouths and not their instruments. Otherwise, we'd have a lot more people in a lot more shape because we have lots and lots of contacts with people. And then, of course, they pose or a threat. They pose or are a threat to others in the way of grievous bodily harm or death. And there's no question. And we have another incident that I'll just share with you, and then I'll actually turn it back over to Kyle, because I'm sure you have some comments. Kyle is one of the trainers, I believe, and he's one of the use of force experts for Blood Tribe. Our young fellow tonight has been busy. He's been working 12 hours a day for the last week trying to provide firearms training to each and every one of our officers in our service. So he was just, quite honestly today, pretty tired, and he said, I'd rather not go if I don't have to. So he's not here. But we also like to look at the successes, and really, as I said, I've been a chief for just about 2 years now. I've been part of the executive for the last 5 years in our service and have a chance to review every one of these reports, and I'm only aware of the one incident in the spring where we took it to a further investigation. But I'm aware of a number of situations, a domestic dispute where we had a suicidal male with a knife. We were able to contain that individual and get him to hospital with no injury to himself or anyone else. Assault of subject, he came after a police officer and he was resisting arrest, and he was subdued with the conducted energy device, the taser. No injuries resulted. Met an emotionally disturbed male with a weapon at the hospital. He was actually threatening the nurses in the hospital. We were able to come on scene, take that weapon away from that individual, subdue him, and get proper care for him. We had a weapon complaint, an individual that had been indicated in a threat with a big, large machete at a residence. We stopped the vehicle, he got out of the vehicle, he came at police swinging the machete, and unfortunately in my career I've seen two individuals that have been shot to death swinging machetes at police officers here in our community, and both of those individuals suffer from mental illness, and it just was a tragedy all the way around. Nobody wins. He came out of his weapon swinging the machete, and the officers were able to tase him and get him to help and save him. The only option there was lethal force. And then we had the recent one of a robbery, commercial robbery. An individual walked in, and on tape you can clearly see that he had his pocket, and it was a tube of toothpaste, if you can believe it. But the store staff was able to engage him, talk with him while somebody in the back room phoned. We showed up as this male exited the store with the information that a robbery was taking place, and the male had a weapon, a revolver. Clearly, I'll tell you, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we would have shot him. in officer safety and everything else. If he would have made the wrong gestures and the wrong compliance to demands, he probably would have been shot. And we were able to tase him and found out it was a tube of toothpaste. And I can tell you very, very clearly that there isn't an officer in my service, and I don't think an officer in Alberta, and I'll say an officer in Canada, and I may not go into the States because they have their issues down there, that would not be sick to death if he found out that he had killed an individual carrying a tube of toothpaste. It's a trauma that you're not going to get over very easily in the Canadian society. And then the most recent one where the individual was assaulting an individual, we got called out, we attended the assault of the police officers, and then he was tased, and there was a review on it. So we see each and every one of those, and we move along. Other than that, you know, there is, and it's open to church interpretation, and I think Don did a great job of pointing that out. Each inquiry hears many different viewpoints. Right now, the Canadian Police Research Council is undertaking another study. It's ongoing. That will impact the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police, who will make recommendations to us. As it stands in Alberta right now, the Alberta Solicitor General endorses the use of conductive energy devices. He has based that on the research and stuff that he has done for him by individuals. The medical examiner in Alberta has come out and said that tasers do not cause death. Right now, Dr. Hall out of Vancouver, an emergency doctor, has spoken recently, and it's one of the reports. I think, Don, maybe that was the one you said is tabled for a while. And what she's done is she's turned it back to medical doctors now and said, give me your feedback. And the information she provided us at council is 96.4% of people, if tased, regardless of medical condition, would not suffer. And she said, I am not paid for or sponsored by Taser International. I am not paid for or sponsored by the police. I am a medical physician. I make a career in emergency wards treating and preventing death. When I saw deaths occurring because of maybe use of force or because of conductive energy devices, I've conducted my own study, and those are her findings. She's turned that back to her field of fellows, and they are going to review that, and then that report will be coming out. But that's the brief highlight she has. When you look at the weapon, voltage is what carries current. Amperage is what kills. The amperage of our X26 taser, we have 11 of them in our service right now. 3 to 5 individuals on each team would be carried. So whilst we have 11, it's like anything else, you have a few extras, but probably on any average given night, we'd have 3 to 5 of them on the street with different officers. Not every officer carries them. Ideally, you provide a level of safety to each officer, but those have 0.0021 amps. It takes 1 amp to light the little tiny light bulb on your Christmas tree. So the ampage with these, and the voltage is 50,000. When you walk across your floor at night scuffing your feet, studies show that the voltage that you generate is anywhere from 30 to 100,000 volts when you slap the door. So you get that little pain, and sometimes that pain is greater than other times. And so these are the things we're looking at. There are studies there. We do exhaustively look at it as the CACP and the research coordinators. So I wanted to talk to that. And excited delirium is one other thing, and I think that was addressed there. It simply is a condition. It's not it's a symptom. It's not a condition. Much the same if you go to the hospital, you didn't die from a pain in the chest. That was a symptom of your heart attack that killed you. Excited delirium is aware, and it is present, especially in those with supplemental trauma and those that are under in any influence of alcohol, in particular cocaine or drugs that really, really highly elevate the systems and the brain systems. And it is present not only in taser deaths, it's present in OC deaths, it's in its presence in cell block deaths where we've actually had to subdue and handcuff people. There's many, many cases of excited delirium. And our officers do recognize it when they see it on the street. And in fact, we've taken people to hospital, and the doctors have said, you know what, but for the good grace of God, this person is alive, and you got him here in time. We've also seen situations where people have passed away in the city, and they've attributed it to just exactly that, an excited delirium-induced heart attack, or just system shutdown, where their bodies overheat so badly that everything just shuts down. And it's a natural defense mechanism of the body, so it's there. There are numerous reports and studies, as has been indicated by Don. He's done a good job of capitalizing a lot of those. I'm aware of some of his new studies. I'll be sharing those with our use of force people. So to wrap up, I'm very pleased to be here. I'm pleased to see you folks are out here and you are worried about how we're conducting our business because it is your business. I'm very pleased to share with you that we are accountable. We have strict policy and procedures. We have a reporting of each of our officers on this use and review each one of those very seriously, as we do with any use of force by our officers, be it from their batons, their OC sprays, their tasers, or their weapons, their Smith & Wessons that they carry on their side right now, or the SIG cals that we're moving to that are going to be a 40 caliber. And I'd be pleased to answer any questions after the break, and at that I'll turn it over to Kyle or to Chief Byers, and sorry for hogging the airtime.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here tonight. I will echo the some of the comments of Chief McKenzie, with one exception. He, in fact, did receive his training in the mid, not the late 70s. And I'm prepared tonight to speak on behalf of Blood Drive Police Service and no other agencies in the province or in the country, because that's where I'm currently the chief of, and I'm very familiar with the program we have there. We do have a very in-depth. I also would like to thank Don for his comments, and I don't take issue with most of his presentation. I would have an issue with the police using any tool as a weapon of torture. That's just unacceptable anywhere. Our service is responsible for public safety on the Blood Indian Reserve, and the horrible treatment of people won't be tolerated in 2008. We do have a lot of, I don't know the exact number, I can tell you that every person, operational officer that we have at Blood Drive Police Service is issued, trained, and does carry a taser instrument when they do go on patrol. It's, I do support the concept of the instrument, and we do have a very in-depth and thorough accountability system in place that Sergeant Melting Tallow will share with you immediately after I'm done here. I'm not going to take a lot of time. I believe Chief McKenzie did cover most of the issues that I was prepared to speak on. I would like to share one incident that we had in 2007. And without question, if our officer wasn't carrying the CED weapon that night, we would have had a shooting fatality. And this happened in 2007. All of our usages are downloaded and they are capsulized in narrative format that I do share with the police commission, and I will share with the Blood Tribe Police and Council, or Chief and Council as well. I firmly believe in being accountable, and this allows us to do that. The incident I'm going to describe was a lone female member located a male involved in an armed robbery. He was commanded to present himself for arrest, but turned around and took a swing to punch at the member. The CED was drawn, and the taser challenge was issued by the member. But as the command was ignored, the CED was deployed into the subject. It was proved ineffective due to a cartridge failure. The male then flees and hides between two nearby vehicles. The member re-engaged the male at gunpoint and commanded him to comply with the arrest. The male took a fighting stance and did not comply with commands. While still at gunpoint, the member deployed OC spray into the face of the male, and he fled. The member then holstered her firearm, changed cartridges in the CED, and gave chase. The male stopped, turned towards the member, and returned to a fighting stance. The CED was once again deployed into the male, this time proving effective. The male was safely taken into custody without further incident. And again, by describing that incident that young lady faced that night, I would have no doubt that she would have had to take the most critical action possible. This allowed her to have another option, not to have to take that drastic action. And without continuing further, I would turn it over to Sergeant Melting Tallow, and he can provide some better detail than I can respecting the process he goes through into ensuring that Blood Tribe Police is in fact accountable.
Good evening, everyone. I am the TASER coordinator for the Blood Tribe Police Service, and in that, I look after all the use of force that are submitted, whether that be the TASER, the baton, the OC, and more or less for hand-to-hand or hard techniques to bring somebody safely into custody. But I'll talk mostly about the CED tonight, and what it involves is, firstly, each one of our members, 22 members, are issued their own taser. This promotes better accountability, where the tasers are actually signed out to these members, where they are serial numbered out, they're signed for them, and as well as their two air cartridges that they are also signed out to that one taser, which are also serial numbered, so that this member, he has three pieces of equipment on him, two air cartridges, one taser that are serial numbered. So therefore, there can't be any switching of tasers or cartridges. So that member is accountable. At the beginning of his shift, he would do what would be considered a spark test. He would engage his taser and give it a 1 second spark test. So basically, you saw a little photo of it up here earlier, where it's just a little bit of the electricity going between the probes. That's called the spark test. So it basically, it would enable the member to know that his taser is actually working, and he would holster up and go to the go out to his shift, report for his duty. Now, when we download this information, we do it pretty much about 6 weeks or anywhere after a deployment. What it entails is hooking that taser, the CED, up to a central computer and downloading all the data that's in there. Download would say how long the deployment was for, as well as what time it was. The times are all tracked to one central computer so that you can track down exactly when, time of day, that this taser was fired. Most importantly is the duration, whether it was a 5 second, 10 second, 20 second deployment. Then you get into the excessive use part. That's what we review. If it's all within the parameters, whether it's the 1 second spark test, which is generally what we like the members to do, as well, in addition to the 5 seconds, where we know there's a deployment, we can investigate that. We can say, okay, what happened here? Why did you deploy this taser for 5 seconds? That member, at the end of his shift, or therefore as soon as possible, submits a use of force report to his supervisor, whether it be his sergeant, and then that would go into what Chief McKenzie was talking about, goes up the chain of command to the inspectors all the way to the chief's office. So all of these use of forces are reviewed so that these members are being held accountable. There's only two instances where a taser should be deployed, one being the spark test and the other one being an actual deployment. Anywhere out of there, out of those two areas, there would be an investigation. Say, for instance, a member was spark testing his taser at about 7 a.m., started his shift, 3 in the afternoon, he has a deployment. Why was that there? Was it necessary? So those are the things we investigate when we download an actual taser and make sure that they are well within the use of the force. And we, in Blood Tribe, use a model similar to this up here, where we, intermediate weapons would be where our taser, or CED, would be. So we would engage a person where they would be in the active resistant area all the way up to more combative assaultive behavior. In the year 2007, we had 16 deployments, and this year so far, we've had 10 deployments. It's down a few, but we're hoping that with the use of more verbal interaction with the community, we'll be able to talk the people into custody as opposed to using force. That's the ultimate goal that we get out there. But these are just tools that we have to utilize to bring somebody safely into custody. So that's all I wanted to add as far as Blood Tribe Police Service is concerned. And we'll hopefully have a question or two for me later on. Thank you.
One of these strengths you like, I think this is water there, it is more juice, so you may want some of that. But we need your questions, that's really important. So let's just do a break, you know, we're going to stand up if you need to and get the blood flowing. And then in 2 or 3 minutes, we'll be looking for your questions. And thank you very much, gentlemen. Bye.